Book of Mormon History, we provide easy access to current research for your personal study. Today, I am thrilled to share the moment with researcher Neil Rapley as he unearths a new discovery related to the Book of Mormon. Ishmael was buried in a place which was called Nahum, and recently, Neil identified a funerary stela with the name Ishmael in the right place, dating to Book of Mormon time periods. Let's listen in to our conversation. This is Josh Gailey, and welcome back to the Book of Mormon History Podcast. We've had a large gap between episodes while I've been working on a book manuscript, so I figure we're just going to call this the start of season two. I'm joined today by Neil Rapley, who positively identified a plausible correlation to the Book of Mormon in ancient Arabia. Neil has spent his professional career with his hands all in on Book of Mormon research. He holds a BA in history from Utah State University, and his work has been published by the Interpreter Foundation, Fair Mormon, the Book of Mormon Archaeological Forum, Meridian Magazine, and many other locations. His award-winning research was recognized by Fair Mormon when presenting Neil the John Taylor Defender of the Faith Award in 2013. He currently works for Book of Mormon Central as operations manager and research project manager. Neil, thanks so much for coming on the program today to discuss one of the most remarkable discoveries regarding the Book of Mormon in recent memory.
Thanks for having me.
So as we get started, we'll start from the macro and work our way in. What first launched your interest in studying the historicity of the text of the Book of Mormon? Was this the career path you always envisioned for yourself?
That's a great question. I guess my interest really kind of begins when I was serving as a missionary for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints out here in Utah. But, you know, I was serving out in Virginia, and I had a lot of interactions with various people of different Christian backgrounds and things like that. And I was the kind of person back then that really hated not knowing what he was talking about or not being right or being able to prove I'm right all the time. And through those experiences in various discussions, I kind of had determined when I got home and would have, you know, more time and more access to resources, I wanted to really dive in and dig into the research that's been done and some of the apologetics for defending both the early history of the Restoration and also the Book of Mormon. And I got home, this was back in 2008, and that's just kind of how I dove in. And the first book I got was Hugh Nibley's Lehi in the Desert.
I think that was my first too.
Yeah, I mean, I find that tends to be like a starting point for a lot of people, even though it's, you know, so many decades old. That's where I started. And I had this naive notion that I was going to spend a few months reading a few different books on Lehi's trail and stuff like that. I was going to figure that all out in a few months, and then I was going to move on to doing the rest of the Book of Mormon. And obviously, that's not really how it worked out. And probably most of my research has been done in historical setting for First Nephi, but that's really where the passion kind of started, was starting to read Hugh Nibley and, you know, a few other things at the same time. I loved it and I never looked back. I just really kind of fell in love with that sort of stuff.
Well, there's a part of me that is definitely jealous because I still have a day job and I would love to be able to take that day job hat off and not be doing this at 8 o'clock at night. Before we do editing at 1 o'clock in the morning, before we go live at whatever time that we're able to pull this off. I have personally benefited from and really enjoy Book of Mormon Central. It's a great tool and a great resource. So we're going to get laser focused now into the area that you have spent the majority of time studying and focused in on. And that's where the Book of Mormon opens up. I, Nephi, having been born of goodly parents, and we see the cultural and the backdrop and the setting of Nephi and Lehi in Jerusalem around 600 BC as the 7th century turns into the 6th and goes on. Jeremiah is a prophet in the region. Daniel in the Bible would have been probably a young man at the time. We can get some parallels, some contemporaries that are happening. God commands Lehi to flee, take this incredible trip into the wilderness. The first and second books of the Book of Mormon tell this marvelous story of a journey and a beginning for this group in the Promised Land. Would you tell us the big picture of where they were traveling from Jerusalem? Give us the lay of the land, so to speak, from maybe Jerusalem to Bountiful.
So yeah, the big picture really is they leave Jerusalem and they go down south to the Red Sea for a variety of reasons. That's generally assumed to be the Gulf of Aqaba branching off from the Red Sea is where they most likely come down and make first contact with the sea. You know, the text says then that they travel another 3 days and they stop at the Valley of Lemuel. They go from the Valley of Lemuel south-southeast is what the text tells us to Shazer. And then it tells us they keep going in the same direction or nearly the same course from Shazer until they reach a place called Nahom. And then from Nahom, which is where they bury Ishmael, they go nearly eastward from that point until they arrive at Bountiful. And that's kind of the big picture. You've got a south-southeast leg, an eastward leg, and they're traveling along or near the coast of the Red Sea. They're in Arabia, really, the whole time. That's kind of the big picture overview.
One thing that I find interesting with this part of studying the Book of Mormon from a historical aspect is the fact that when we get to the New World, I could probably find you 100 different maps. Now, some of them might be from, you know, similar. Maybe we're debating a river. Maybe we're, you know, but we can get a lot of different maps, a lot of different scopes and perspectives. When it comes to the Old World, essentially, there's one map that might be drawn depending on who's drawing it, but they're hitting the same points. There's consistency. When we look at the Old World, we pretty much know the journey. I guess one question I wanted to do as we get started is, why is that so much more consistent? Why is there so much more consensus there? What makes us so certain of the journey for Lehi and Nephi?
Oh, well, I think there's a lot of things that go into that, but it helps a lot that we know our starting point. We've got Jerusalem on the map. We can put that on the map and we know that's where they start. And then we also know where they go because we know where the Red Sea is. These two key points here, we know where those things are. You know, there's only so much variation you can really get from there. And then we do actually have pretty specific directions from Nephi. So once you have those key starting points and ways to kind of triangulate where we should be looking for places like the Valley of Lemuel and Nahom and Bountiful and so forth, there's only so much variation you could possibly get within that overall framework. It really kind of narrows the focus of where we're looking for certain stuff and what we're looking for.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think, you know, I remember way back when I was in college and we were in field school for archaeology. You know, you start with a datum and then you start plotting in your squares, but you need your fixed point. You need your datum to be able to plot in the rest of the site so you can map it accurately. You hit the nail on the head. We have Jerusalem and we have the Red Sea. Pretty clear two points that can then transition and help us lay it in the rest of the way. So we actually know as we get on and we start looking for some other places that are listed here along the journey, well, we know where to look for them.
Yeah.
Because we've got the two fixed points and can kind of build off of that model and start drawing it in pretty accurately of where we're supposed to even look in the first place. So when we look at place names in the Book of Mormon and try and place them into the Old World, can you give some perspective, Neil, on just how hard this is? I think people just assume in their mind as they're reading the Bible, well, I know I can find a map of the Bible.
Right.
Because it's in the back of my Bible. But they may not realize the debate and the questions of certain sites and really the minimalist versus maximalist in the Bible that goes on.
Right.
Is there even an established criteria to positively identify place names when it comes to biblical history and archaeology?
I wouldn't say there's an established criteria. There are different criteria that various scholars have used. To this day, people might look at their maps that they get, they come in their Bibles or whatever that they get, and it's got all these place names on there. And first thing I can tell you is those maps don't have all the place names on there, right?
Right?
It's not even remotely close to all the place names that actually show up in the Bible or on those maps. But there are many, many disputes over specific locations in there. And I can't remember the exact numbers off the top of my head, probably upwards of 50% or even more of toponyms in the Bible are questioned or disputed or have multiple plausible candidates for. It's hard to do. One common criteria that's used a lot, which I think is kind of interesting in light of what we'll be talking about a little later, is modern Arabic names for different tells in Arabia. There's often a presumed continuity of tradition there, right? Where they assume if this tell has an Arabic name that is similar to or derived from the Hebrew name in the Bible, they suspect there's some continuity of tradition going on there. And that's not always 100% true, but it's one of the methods that's used to try and identify some of these places.
Jericho to Jericho, for example.
Yeah, exactly. There's just so many that are uncertain and can't even be triangulated very well with just everything, despite everything we know. And despite the fact that there has probably been more money and resources poured into archaeology of the Holy Land than anywhere else in the world, we still can't pin down so many of the places on the map. And it's not just minor or insignificant places that can be hard to pin down. There are disputes over the location of Mount Sinai. There are, you know, almost everywhere in the Exodus story, that whole journey, working out those itineraries and connecting those dots, there's so much debate over all of those places. It's an ongoing thing. And it's, you know, there's a lot of challenges and methodological questions and things that people don't always think about or grasp that can be really hard, even when you have something like the Bible, where, again, you know at least the general area you're supposed to be looking, and you've got several places you can pin in the map with pretty good certainty, that still doesn't give you enough information to figure out the rest of the map. It really is a challenging problem that, and it's not just a biblical problem. Anyone who's doing work with any kind of ancient text and is trying to figure out its geography, there's a lot of question marks that they have to grapple with.
Yeah, and I think when we tie that into the Book of Mormon, it just gives a little bit of perspective as we dive in, because 50% is a huge number. Say it's not even 50, say it's 40% in the Bible, sure, of sites that we would be looking for and not be able to positively identify. That's a massive number, considering between Jerusalem and Rome, more shovels have been in the dirt in those two places than anywhere else in the world.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
You know, it's remarkable. And even on like the biggest scale of some of the biggest names in the Bible that have ever lived, you wrote an article where you kind of said, hey, let's roll back and at least be honest between our texts. When you wrote your article in the Interpreter Foundation, the title of the article was Book of Mormon Minimalists and the Nahum Inscriptions, which we'll get to, a response to Dan Vogel. You even talked about the bigger picture between the fact of, hey, we believe King David lived, but not everybody does. Not everybody does. Could you talk about the discovery that was made that kind of opened the door? Because for a long time, there was not even a scrap of evidence for King David. And that was really picked apart for decades within the archaeological community regarding the Bible.
And that's something, it's even still debated today, despite the evidence that we have. Some decades ago, there was a discovery at Tel Dan of a stela. And in that stela, it talks about the house of David, the Bayet David, the house of David, or David, I should say, if I'm really trying to say the Hebrew right. It dates to the 8th century BC. It's pretty much etched in stone, definitive evidence that there was a David, that he was a monarch who started a dynasty that 150 years later or so was still ruling in Israel. This is a slam dunk evidence that was found. Like I said, I know that there was a lot of debate going on about it in the 90s and things like that, because even though you've got this inscription that's very clear and specific, people who had built their careers arguing that David didn't really exist, they didn't take this lying down. You know, there was a lot of controversy in biblical studies and biblical archaeology and stuff as they tried.
Finkelstein and others were in the middle of the.
They're all trying to downplay this and say, well, it's not really evidence that there was a David. It could mean this. It could mean that. Some even went so far as to try and say it was a forgery. It's not. It's an authentic stela. There's no doubt about that. Biblical studies kind of was rocked by this. And there's this propensity I've noticed. They're constantly wanting to date all the material in the Bible to later and later and later. But the actual, what we're actually finding when we're digging in the dirt, and this is what I find in other disciplines, not just in biblical old world stuff, it's happening in New World with Mayan and Mesoamerican archaeology as well. stuff that we thought was later is constantly being found to go back to earlier and earlier periods. And so these trends are somewhat at odds with each other, but the actual in the dirt material finds that we're finding are constantly pushing things back earlier rather than later than we thought. And that's what happened here with the Tel Dan Sealik. We had, you know, inscriptional evidence of saying, no, David wasn't some myth made up later. This was a real guy who had a real dynasty and, you know, real king of Israel. So there you have it.
And it's a great backdrop as we now start looking into some Book of Mormon sites within the same larger region that we can keep that in our mind as we look at Nahum, as we look at Bountiful, as we look at some of these places. Just how profound and strong the evidence does sway for the Book of Mormon pendulum, considering some of the limitations that are even out there for biblical sites. So along the journey, Nephite reports the death of somebody in the group. Who died? Where did he die? And what are some of the unique circumstances in this event, which this event actually presents regarding Book of Mormon locations on the map?
The person who dies is Ishmael. Exactly who Ishmael is, we don't know, but he becomes their traveling companion. And he really is, you know, he's Nephi and his brothers. He's their father-in-law. And this is someone that surely had become an important person in their life during the time that they're traveling there. And we don't know enough about the circumstances to know exactly why he dies at this point. But, you know, he dies and it's a traumatic experience for the family. We know the daughters of Ishmael are said to mourn there. And surely the whole family was really mourning. But the place that's associated with that, though, in 1 Nephi 16:34 is a place called Nahum. And, you know, Nahum, however you want to say it. What's significant about that place is as Lehi and his family are going through on their journey, through most of the text, it's pretty explicit that Lehi, or it'll either say Lehi himself or we as in the group, called the place or named the place the Valley of Lemuel, the River of Laman. Shazer is a name that's given by Lehi and his family. Later we get Bountiful and Eriantum, both names that are explicitly given by Lehi and his family. That's not what happens with Nahum. It's just the place that was called Nahum. That tells us a couple of things. It hints at a couple of things, I should say. One, it hints that this name is already established there in the area, and it's external to Lehi's family. Unlike these other places where unless Nephi himself carved something on a rock about it, we're not going to find explicit evidence for these toponyms other places. This is an independently existing place outside of Lehi and his family. So we theoretically could find it on a map. The other thing about that is it tells us they must have interacted with people who could tell them that's the name, right? You don't learn names of places just by osmosis or something, by just being there, right? You know, people talk to you and they tell you, yeah, this is what this place is called. So they must have interacted with some people in the process of either burying Ishmael or just maybe as part of the journey in general. And from those people, they must have learned this external name from them, this name Nahum.
George Potter, Warren Aston spent decades and decades studying this trail, this journey, this path. And Warren Aston, at a specific point, took a particular interest in the search for this place because it had a name. The name was not given, as you just said, by Lehi or Nephi. This was a real place that would have existed at the time they arrived into it when the burial takes place. We look at that. How did Warren Aston go about searching for a place called Nahum? And could you talk a little bit about the discovery and how that began to unravel?
As Warren Aston tells the story, he was just riding the bus to work, and he had grabbed an old Ensign magazine. And there was a note in this Ensign article from a guy named Ross Christensen, who was an archaeologist at BYU, who had been out in Israel and had participated in digs. And on his way back from one of his digs, another person, but this was 1977, this person gives him a book. And the book that he gives him has a map in it. And the map has the name Nahum written on it. It's a map of Arabia. I should be more specific. It's not just Nahum out in the middle of nowhere, right? Yeah, it's of Arabia. And he can see in Yemen, there's a place called Nahum. And he looks at that And he knows First Nephi. He knows the general whereabouts of where Lehi's family should be. And he's like, oh my goodness, that might be Nahum. And so he publishes a note about this in our magazine, The Ensign. Warren Aston sees that and he says, oh my goodness, that might be Nahum. He thinks the same thing, but he's wondering, has anybody else followed up on this?
And he's reading it going, tell me more. What else is there? Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. He's like, okay, and this is 6 years ago. He's doing this in 1984. So he's like, surely someone has followed up on this. Well, it turns out no one had followed up on it up to that point.
Began a lifelong path for Warren Aston, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. He felt guided by this, by the Lord in the process, and with good reason. There were some things that happened to him that you just thought, wow, God's hand was in this to make sure this was going to happen. But he begins doing research. He has the opportunity to go out there to Yemen and also to Oman. And he starts looking for both more information on Nehem or Nahum. And he also starts surveying the coast to try and find, hey, can we find a plausible place for Bountiful? We have a lot of information on what's there at Bountiful. So he starts surveying the coast of Arabia in Yemen and Oman, looking for plausible sites there. And that continues on. He's doing that for a number of years, and he's able to find out more about this name Nehem. He finds that it refers to a tribe there in Yemen that has been there for a very, very long time. He's able to find documents at this point in time. He's able to find documents that take him back to the early Islamic period, with hints in the documents themselves that this is a pre-Islamic name that goes back even earlier, but can't really confirm that just yet. He finds that it's spelled variously. These are Semitic languages, which in their Semitic script usually don't include vowels, right? And so the key letters here are NHM, and it's spelled NEHEM. It's spelled NAHAM. There's a whole bunch of different spellings that he's finding in the various documents. You know, it's all the same name. The common consonants, NHM, are consistent with the Book of Mormon name, Nahum. And that's kind of where he leaves it, you know, after about a decade's worth of research. And he publishes in the 1990s, he publishes a book kind of saying, okay, this is where we're at on this. And then, of course, a few years later, really the big discovery gets made here. There's a team of archaeologists that are working in Marib in Yemen. They find an altar that has this same name, this NHM name on it, referring to an individual who had donated the altar to the temple in antiquity as a Nehemite, or, you know, a person from Nehem. It's not us. It's the archaeologists out there, the German archaeologists.
German archaeologists, yeah.
Yeah. They're saying, you know, based on everything about where this was found, everything, this dates to the 6th or 7th century BC. So it's like, okay, this confirms that this region and this tribe, Nehem, existed at this time and place right in Lehi's day.
Dating to the right time period, located in the place the Book of Mormon describes, with an eastward turn from that point on that would take you directly to where Warren Aston positively identified Bountiful in southern Oman. I think in your article, you had 5 points that interlock details which match the Book of Mormon Nahum and Nehem in southern Arabia. All 5 are interlocking with the Book of Mormon text. And when you see those points converge in archaeology and that overlay goes one right on top of the other, and they're all pinpointing the same thing, that's what we would call in the archaeological record a bullseye, right? Yeah. I mean, that is dead on. Yeah. And it wasn't just the first, it was the first inscription, but there ended up being 3 different inscriptions on identical altars, which identified the tribe, helps us locate the place, and backdate that tribe's location and this area as the Nehem territory dating to Book of Mormon times, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. There ended up being 3 altars from that dig specifically that confirm the name Nehem is there. And there's actually in the time since it turns out I've gone through some of the corpus of South Arabian inscriptions. Warren Aston also, he actually did this before me. And then I just kind of said, hey, I'm going to look at this stuff because it sounds cool too. There are actually several other inscriptions that also mention the Nehem tribe. A few of them do go back to the 7th century. Some of them are from later, but there's as many as, I want to say as many as 15 at this point.
15?
Well, I guess
double digits. Safe to say double digits.
Double digits. There's at least 11, but maybe 15. Okay.
I had no idea. That's astounding.
So some of them are duplicates, right? Just like these three altars, they actually have the same text on them over and over again.
Sure.
And some of it is a little debatable because there's some question. The word NHM in ancient South Arabian languages means stonemasons or stone masonry. It can refer to the process of working stone. It can refer to the stones that have been worked, and it can refer to the people who work stone, right? And it can be a verb that is used to talk. Okay, he's doing stone masonry, right? So it's used in a variety of ways. And so there's some debate in a few of these inscriptions as to whether it's referring to the tribe or whether it's referring to stonemasons. I've actually gone through and I've had some correspondence with a scholar in South Arabian studies on a couple of these that I was like, other people are saying that's stonemasons, but I think that's the tribe and I have my reasons. And I talked to this scholar. I won't say their name because they didn't give me permission to divulge this personal correspondence, but they told me, you know what? I think you're right. I think you've got this figured out. And those are references to the tribe rather than stonemasons. There's a number of inscriptions at this point that confirm the antiquity of the name.
Boy, it'd be nice to publish just a whole list so people could see it and make their own informed decisions. Just right. To circle back, there's no debate on the ruined temple, which inscribes the word NHM, because it says son of the, basically the Nehemite. So it's definitely at the time period of the Book of Mormon identifying the tribe and the region. There's no debate on those three altars.
No,
correct.
No. And that's part of what's called the onomastic formula in a lot of these inscriptions, where they have like just this pattern of how do we identify a person? And there's some variations, but what you expect there is you're going to get an identification of the person. You'll get a patronym. And then, I mean, in this case, we've got two patronyms, and there's some debate on that second patronym. Is that a lineage name or is that like literally the name of his grandfather? There's debate there. But then what you get next is his tribal affiliation, and there's no debate there. And one thing I do want to say, I guess this is maybe now is as good a time as any to address this. Some of the critics will get really want to split hairs and be like, okay, but is it the name of a place or is it the name of a tribe? Well, tribes.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Tribes live places, right? They, you know, you put them on maps. I've never seen anyone.
The land really, of Moab, the land of Edom. Right. This is what we're talking about here.
Yeah, right. This is not something I've seen anyone actually split hairs about in the actual field of South Arabian studies. Tribal names get treated as toponyms all the time by the scholars. They get treated as toponyms all the time in the inscriptions. There really is no point in trying to parse that. One scholar that I read has specifically talked about how when the tribal name or tribal affiliation is used in this onomastic formula, it binds or identifies that person and ties them to both the tribe and its territory. So it really has kind of a dual function as both I'm from this tribe and I'm from the place of this tribe. And in fact, specifically dealing with those inscriptions, I've tried to track down every publication that's been made on them. And they're hard to find because not very many of them are in English. They're largely published in Europe in Italian and German and stuff like that. Every publication but one, three out of four publications that I've been able to track down on these inscriptions specifically, they specifically say Bithar is from the region of Nehem. The scholars are interpreting this specifically as a reference to being from the region Nehem. Like I said, there's one source that says he's from the tribe Nehem. But again, I've seen scholars literally in when they're cataloging the names in the inscriptions they're studying, they'll put in the back, they'll have toponyms and they'll list all the tribal names that show up in those inscriptions because they're toponyms too. They're treated as to designate the land where the tribe lives.
And that's interchangeable.
Yeah, absolutely.
There are burial mounds within that territory that date to the correct time period, Book of Mormon times when Ishmael is buried.
Yes, and this is where things do get a little tricky because one of the things that's really hard to do, we can define the boundaries of the Nehem tribe in modern times. We know where they're, the full boundaries of their influence. it's a little hard to be, you know, we can't draw hard lines on exactly where their boundaries are. We know they're in the same area. Did they have greater control of a larger extent territory, a smaller territory? We can't pin those boundaries down with exact precision.
Nobody put a stick in the sand, drew a circle around where they were living, and then wrote 600 BC. Nobody did that?
Yeah, unfortunately, no, that was never done. This is just kind of teaser, I guess. I am working on some material that is going to get us a little closer to knowing better what the boundaries were earlier than modernity. Going back to early Islamic times, our records actually do allow a reconstruction. It's actually really interesting, really suggests more expansive territory in certain ways. It's kind of in process. I'm still kind of fleshing that out. But we can get closer, and the further back we get, it seems like they actually are controlling more territory rather than less.
I know when I zoom in on Google Earth, they look awfully close. The burial mounds that are around, this is one of the beautiful things, right? I can't exactly fly into Yemen and live for very long. But I can zoom in on satellites with Google Earth, and the burial mounds are, we're not talking about 30-mile distance. I mean, they're very close. So yes, it's within walking distance. If we want to dispute territorial lines, I guess we can, but it's not like we're talking about 50 miles here.
Well, I should maybe preface, understanding that there's some ambiguity about their exact boundaries in antiquity is important, but there are definitely burial mounds that are within their territory, whatever the exact boundaries are, because they're like right in the heart of where they are, right? And then there's some that you get out to the periphery a little more, and it's like, okay, we can document that those were in their territory in some points in history, and they could have been there in Lehi's day, but we can't necessarily prove that. But they're right along the edge and the border. And what's actually interesting is, according to some of the scholars I've read, these burial mounds are meant as territorial markers. And so, you know, the burial mounds themselves may actually be the evidence that this is where the boundary was, right? Going back in a very, very long time, whether it was with the same groups of people or not at all times and all periods of history, these are marking territorial boundaries in a lot of ways. But yes, there's definitely burial mounds that are within their territory. And then there's some that are kind of on the periphery and around the general vicinity as well that may or may not have been under their control at the time. There's no doubt they could have given Ishmael a proper burial in this region at that time and that place.
So we know Ishmael dies. He's buried in a place called Nahum. It's been, with significant strength of evidence, positively identified in a real world map dating to the correct time period. You recently published an article, and this is the whole point for the backdrop, right? This is all a backdrop to go, hey, we just green lighted something. There's a new article out. It's worth reading. It's compelling. There's a case to be made, a plausible case to be made here that's exciting and fun. Obviously, we have to be careful about what conclusions we make with it. But as we go, you published an article titled "An Ishmael Buried Near Nahum." You state in your article, and I'm going to quote this, in 2008, a corpus of over 400 crudely carved funerary stela recovered from the Wadi Jaf were published by the National Museum there. So before we look at those results, I have a sincere question. How in the world do you find a 2008 corpus of these funerary stela to even read through? How did you do that?
That's a great question. I really was not looking for that specifically. I was doing a lot of research at the time. I started kind of wanting to go back through a lot of what Warren Aston and George Potter and some of the others who've worked in this before. I started wanting to say, okay, I want to actually look at some of this evidence for myself. And so I was trying to track down, you know, some of the inscriptions and the publications on the inscriptions that mention the Nahum tribe or the Nahum place, and read them for myself, and started going through the footnotes in a lot of Warren Aston's publications and George Potter, and Kent Brown's another one that, contributed to all this, and, you know, several other people. I just started going through the footnotes, trying to track down their publications, and I started trying to look through the inscriptions themselves a lot. And I started to see if there were even more that other people hadn't noticed. like I said, Warren Aston actually started finding some of these additional ones before I did, but I was like, hey, if there's more, there might be even more. Let's just keep looking. And so I don't remember exactly how I came upon this specifically. I'm pretty sure I found it on academia.edu.
If you'd have said Google, I'd have been like, oh, come on, man. Yeah. All right. No. Academia.edu. Okay. And you're probably searching in a foreign language to do that as you're looking this up.
This catalog actually is published. It's dual published in English and Arabic.
There we go.
Side by side. I think it might even have French in it now that I think about it. I somehow came upon the page for a particular scholar who had contributed to this catalog. And so I'm going through his academia.edu page, and I'm just kind of saying, well, while I'm here, I may as well scan over the publication titles and see if there's anything else interesting here. I come across this, and I kid you not, I downloaded it, and I looked at it, and the first thing I did, it was OCR'd. It was a PDF that was OCR'd. So the first thing I did is I just searched NHM. I said, that's all I really want to find is there NHM in this? No, there wasn't NHM in it. Okay, well.
Keep going.
Yeah, keep going. Move on. I thought, well, maybe, because these are funerary stela, and this Wadi Jaf, this is right along the borders where the Nehem tribe has been located for as long as we can document, going all the way back, like we said, back to Lehi's day with the inscriptions and everything. So I thought this could be some interesting contextual material. This is about death and burial in that region. And this could give us an idea of maybe how Ishmael was buried, what they maybe did to mark his burial or whatever.
Culture of the area, funerary practices could help us maybe visualize how it occurred doing this along the journey, which would be cool. Sure.
Yeah. So that's kind of all I'm thinking in deciding I'm going to hang on to this. And then I move on. And it's like a week later, I completely have forgotten that I even found that in the first place. And I'm going through all the files I downloaded over the last week, and I'm trying to organize them. And I come across that again. And I literally, because I had forgotten everything, apparently, I literally make the same mistake I did last time. I say, well, let's see if it has NHM on any of these. Oh, nope. Well, I guess this might be kind of cool for some context we can flesh out later or something, but that's not what I'm looking for right now.
So two strikes.
And then I'm like, I'm sitting there, I'm working on some other things, and then I'm like, wait a second. Those are funerary stela, and they have names on them.
Bingo.
I wonder if any of them have the name Ishmael on.
And you're sitting there going, too good to be true, ain't going to happen.
Yeah.
There's 400 of these.
I'm thinking this is a long shot. There's no way.
But
may as well look.
This is fun, man. This is really fun.
So there was, like, at the beginning of the catalog, there's this introductory material, right, that talks about where these came from. It gives typology for the different styles, and it talks about the proper names that are in them. And then it provides an index of those proper names and which stela specifically have those names on them. And so I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, like, well, what would Ishmael even look like in epigraphic South Arabian script? And I figure, you know, I know how you would write this in Hebrew, and this is a Semitic language too. It's probably going to be something pretty close. So I'm thinking I need to find, you know, a YSM, and then you've got your Ein and then Aleph, and then you've got an L, right? I'm thinking that's the basic thing I should be looking for here. I was fortunate that they had them transcribed in English, right? They had transcribed the names, and well, not in English, but in Latin Roman script, right? They had transcriptions of the names. And so I knew kind of what I was looking for, but I didn't like know for sure, like maybe there's some weird way they would write it here. But, you know, the biggest question was always going to be, okay, if I find this, is it going to be the right S? Because in Semitic languages, there's the sin and the shin, and then there's also the zadi, which is sometimes an S, sometimes a Z, and you've also got the samek. So there's four in Hebrew. There's also four, maybe five actually, in South Arabian script, but there's different S's, and the way they correlate is always kind of tricky. You know, linguists, I'm not a linguist, but linguists have all these rules about, well, if it goes from, and they don't have them, they've studied the languages, and so they've determined these are the rules for when you're taking a name or a word from one Semitic language into another, here's how they switch or change the these different letters or whatever.
Yeah, you had a basic idea. You knew basically what the needle would look like if you could come across it, but you were still looking for a needle in a haystack, basically.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
As you go on here, what do the funerary stela look like? Because everybody's going to be listening to this. How big are they? What are they made out of? What are the inscriptions like? Are there face carvings on? Could you describe this a little bit? Size, shape, look?
The basic look of them is they're kind of oblong or rectangular shaped, and they're positioned long ways. So their average height is probably about a foot tall, maybe 5 inches, 5 to 7 inches wide, and about 3 inches, you know, in depth, right? And they're generally made of limestone, which is kind of the main material you have out there to carve into things. And yeah, they have these, they have like really crudely carved faces in them. And some of them will just have eyes carved into them. Others will have more complete faces. Depending on the typology that you're dealing with, there's like four different typologies for these different, for these stelae. Some of them have it like in a bas relief style. So it's like carved out and is really kind of pops out and at you and stuff, and is a bit more well-developed. Others are just barely kind of etched in there. And that's really what we're kind of dealing with. The one we'll be talking about here soon is it's a pretty roughly incised sketched face in most of these. Provenance is a little uncertain because a lot of these, well, all of them in this particular corpus were looted. And so they do know because of, first of all, they were able to talk to, when artifacts get looted and they end up on the antiquities market, there's always an effort to try and track down as best you can, where did this stuff come from?
Not unlike the Dead Sea Scrolls when they first came out.
I mean, very, very similar to what happens with the Dead Sea Scrolls. And this kind of thing is happening all the time. It's unfortunate in some ways because we'd like to have the provenance and know specifically where it came from. On the other hand, you know probably better than I do, it's expensive to get out there and fund archaeological excavation and digs and stuff like that. And I'm pretty convinced a lot of stuff that gets looted would just never be found if it hadn't been looted in the first place.
You're an optimist.
No one would ever have the funding to go out and dig and get it, you know? So, you know, there's kind of a silver lining there. We get this stuff because it gets looted, but we lose a lot of context because of that. But in conversations with the people, you know, trying to track down, okay, where did some of this stuff come from? A particular site called Harim, which is a city-state, an ancient city-state that was there in the Wadi Jaf, was determined as the provenance or the likely location for many of these. They can't necessarily say that's where they all came from, but that's the one place they were able to pinpoint to saying, these came from Harim here in the Jaf. The analysis of these typologies, as I was talking about, because one of the things is there are stela of a similar style and type being found all throughout Arabia, right?
Right, right.
And one of the advantages of that is it allows some comparative studies to be done. And there are some provenanced ones that have come out of the Jaf area and city-states too. And so they were able to compare typologically these stela to other ones, and they were able to determine, yeah, these did come from the Wadi Jaf. We know that much. Some of them, most likely, maybe many or even all of them, came from the site at Harim, but we don't know that 100% for certain.
Yeah, so what you're describing there, you can look at the stone, scholars can research and go, yeah, this is authentic. Might be coming off black market, but it's authentic. It's real.
Right.
Then you have the archaeological record of different ways people got buried and stones got inscribed over time in different regions. So you can look at the stones and go, okay, this matches here. We know with, and it's always a bell curve, right? 95% certainty or whatever, we're going to say it's from this territory. It's from this landscape dating to this time period because of the type of inscription, all these different things. Because of that, we can locate it here with pretty strong certainty.
Yeah. And I think it's important to stress, I haven't found anyone who specializes in ancient South Arabian studies who either disputes the authenticity of these stones or that their regional association with this area around the Wadi Jaf. Some people, you know, in reaction to this article were like, oh, but they're unprovenanced. They could be from anywhere. You don't really know. Look, guys, if you want to go try and dispute the studies that have been done to pinpoint it to here, be my guest. I'm taking what the experts had to say on this. And if someone comes along and disputes it and has an argument, like, I guess we can look at that. But this is what the experts had to say, and no one in the field is disputing.
No argument, no dispute. It's in the right area, dating to the right, or some are dating to the right time. We'll get
right
there.
Right.
So you're looking for the needle in the haystack. Let's go. Let's find the needle.
So I'm looking there. And like I said, I have a pretty good idea what I should be looking for. And so I look through this index, and sure enough, I couldn't even believe it. I was like, wait a second, really? It's there? You've got a yod, you've got a sot, you've got a mem. And then you get an ein and an aleph. Those are actually, except for the sot, those are exactly what the letters would be in Hebrew as well. And then in Hebrew, it would be the shin instead of the sot. And so I'm looking at that, and I'm like, that's pretty close. Next to the name there, it shows there's six stela in this collection that have that name on it. And it lists which stela they are. Like, they're numbered in the catalog, right? And so, you know, it's got their number next to them. So now I'm like, okay, I'm going to look at each of those.
Absolutely. And your heart had to be pumping.
Oh yeah. I'm honestly starting to feel kind of excited. I'm like, wait, what? Really? So I start skimming through the catalog to find each of these stela that has this name on it. And I wanted to see, how are they translating the name? And then of course I wanted to know, do they have dates on any of these stela? Do they date to the right time?
An Ishmael stela dating to 200 BC makes no correlation. Just, okay, that's cool, but there's no correlation.
Yeah. Right, exactly. And I'm going through, and one after another, these are proving to be dated to later than Lehi's time. That's just happening over and over again. And then I go through each of these, and it turns out there's only one that goes back to Lehi's time. And that was, you know, this one that I published this article on. In the catalog, it said it was dated to the 6th or 5th century BC. I'm like, okay, that's overlapping with the right time. But as I'm reading on more, the same authors who said, okay, it dates to the 6th or 5th century, they actually said that stylistically, it's representative of the 7th or 6th century. And so the dating, the 6th to 5th century dating was kind of based on the paleography, right? The actual script. And then stylistically, the way it was carved and the style in it and everything, that was dated to the 7th to 6th century. And so between those two, I kind of reasoned, this seems to be 6th century BC then. It pulls it maybe to the earlier side of that 6th to 5th century dating.
Picture two circles when they overlap, that
right.
Area in the middle where they intercross. If one piece of the stone seems to represent 7th to 6th and the other piece represents 5th to 6th, that overlap lands you right in the 6th. So it seems pretty undisputed that would be a 6th century BC funerary stela.
Now, I wish we could get a little more specific, you know, because Ishmael's burial is in the 6th century BC. It's obviously in the early part of the 6th century, right? Because, you know, we're dealing with, it's around 600 BC that they leave Jerusalem. They're there for 8 years, right? And so we're talking the 590s BC or maybe 580s. It depends on how you go about, you know, there's different Book of Mormon chronology questions that people have looked into. But, you know, 580s, 590s BC is when we're talking here. Ishmael's burial is early 6th century. This we can only say definitively, most likely 6th century BC, but that's the right time period.
So just to kind of recap this, as we're looking at all this and you're explaining it and it's great detail and information, but what we have is a region from the Book of Mormon positively identified in a real world map, including multiple inscriptions that identify the place name and the people who are living there. And even further, burial mounds within the territory, although territory is a little bit ambiguous, but really within the territory, there are funeral stones from the surrounding territory that have inscriptions on them in the Book of Mormon, a specific man named Ishmael is buried within that territory. You have found a funerary stela with his name dating to the right time from the right place. Of course, we're not saying with 100% certainty or even with 60 or 50% certainty or whatever. There's no percentage on this of that, of is this Ishmael or not. It is a feather in the cap, isn't it?
Absolutely. I titled the article very deliberately, right? An Ishmael near Nahom, because that's, you know, that's the best we can say with certainty. But I'm sitting here, I'm thinking, I mean, I think you summed it up very nicely. I don't disagree with anything, you know, you said there. I'm sitting here, and as I'm looking at it, I'm thinking, well, whatever we can determine about this and the likelihood or unlikelihood that it's him, this is worth telling people about.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, it's like, to put it one way, the Book of Mormon tells us that someone named Ishmael was buried at Nahom in the early 6th century BC. And archaeology does in fact confirm that someone named Ishmael was in fact buried either in or near the Nahom tribal region in the 6th century BC.
In your article, you even elaborated on that and said, I've looked at how common the name was in this area in this time period. So there were multiple stela later, but it wasn't a common name from that time period. It's a rare name in a pretty unique place.
In the entire corpus of South Arabian inscriptions, or at least what's accessible online for that, and I actually have some additional publications that help me flesh this out a little bit, but there's basically 7 to 8,000 inscriptions that we can search in a database that are coming from ancient South Arabia. I was able to search this name in that database and then identify, you know, there's a total of, in the database of thousands of inscriptions, there's a total of, I think it was 27 or 28 attestations of the name Ishmael in South Arabian inscription. And then going through those, though, in the database and looking at when they date to, I was basically able to determine there were only four that date to what they call the early Sabic period. Sabic being the language of the inscriptions here. Early Sabic period basically being the first half of the first millennium BC. Basically, most inscriptions, there's not really a lot of inscriptions before the 8th century, but there are a few. So it's kind of 8th century BC to 4th century BC is kind of the timeline for early Sabic inscriptions. I was then able to study those four, by the way, includes this stela that we're talking about. And going over the rest of those, the other three in that collection, two of them were dated to the 7th century BC. One of them I couldn't get more specific than just it's the early Sabic period. We really have three, maybe four, that you could say date to Lehi's time. And then all the rest of the inscriptions out of thousands, right? All the rest of the attestations of this name are later than Lehi's time. So it is not showing up very frequently in the South Arabian epigraphy. On the other hand, we do know it's a very common name up in Jerusalem at the time, up in Israel and Judah.
Exactly.
Not only because of what we have in the biblical text, right, where we know that there's obviously Ishmael, the son of Abraham, and there's other Ishmaels that come up in the Old Testament, but we have a whole bunch of inscriptions. And this is actually, I didn't put this in the article because it's really just kind of a gee whiz more than anything else. But, you know, a lot of these inscriptions are seals, right, that have like, they'll say so-and-so, son of so-and-so. And there's about 60 examples of the name Ishmael showing up on these seals, all of which date to either the 8th, the 7th, or the 6th century. So we're talking about Lehi's time fairly, you know, in general here. Ishmael is, its origins as a name is Northwest Semitic. It's widely attested as a name in that area in Lehi's time. It is not widely attested in Yemen, in South Arabia at this point. And it's not native to South Arabia. It's a Northwest Semitic name that comes down and gets introduced to those populations, either through trade or through, you know, people like Lehi's family traveling through or whatever, right? It's not widely attested. It's really only just starting to enter their, scholars would call it onomasticon, but their corpus of names around Lehi's time. And so scholars who actually study these funerary stela and stuff, they do analysis on the names. And based on some of the names, which there turns out to be, there's a lot of Northwest Semitic names. There's a lot of Northern Arabian names that are more common in that area. Some scholars have actually argued that these people are either coming from the north and either settling or traveling through the area as traders or whatever, or they had some kind of contact and ties with people of a northern population, and hence they had their names kind of filter into their own onomastics. But, you know, the name itself, it's not impossible that it's a local South Arabian named Ishmael, right? Especially since it is in South Arabian script and it's in a South Arabian style. But the name and the context would seem to suggest it's actually maybe someone either from the north or with ties from the north rather than a local person.
Is there anything else about the Sela? Because this, I think, is just unique. Your article just came out. I mean, we're days into your article. We're not weeks into your article. I'm sure at the same time you're getting emails and responses and critiques and all the fun that comes with publishing something in the Interpreter Foundation. Is there anything else regarding this funerary stela with the name of Ishmael dating to Book of Mormon times at a place that corresponds to a geographic location in the Book of Mormon? Is there anything else there that you think, hey, don't forget this when it comes to this particular discovery?
The one thing I would like to maybe bring up and mention that I think is just another kind of interesting little piece that helps strengthen it overall, even though there's still some uncertainty about this, is, as I mentioned, a lot of these stela are believed to come from a site called Haram in the Wadi Jaf area there. And it's not for nothing that actually some of the inscriptions that we know are from Haram do mention a group of people called the NHMTN, which is a TN is, well, the T and the N are probably both suffix letters in this name. It's the name is NHM. And this is one of those inscriptions I mentioned earlier where there's some debate. Is this referring to stonemasons? Is this referring to the tribe? But it specifically refers to a man called Ammianas, and it calls him the chief of the NHM in these inscriptions. I looked at that and I said, you know what, I think that's probably referring to the tribe. But in the article, I lay out both views. I explain and cite scholars who
sure
take both positions, right? But it's kind of interesting to me that there actually may be a connection to an explicit connection in these inscriptions to the Nehem tribe. And the one place we think these stela may have or most likely came from, not something we can prove. There's a lot of question marks surrounding that. You can go read the article and look at the evidence for yourself if you want to. Like I said, I explain it in a little bit more clearly there, but these are inscriptions and they date to the 7th century. So we have some reason to think if these stela came from Haram, that the Nehem tribe was actually associated with that site at that time.
Wow.
That's something I actually do hope to flesh out a little more in detail in a future publication, looking more specifically at some of the other things we see at Haram and some of the other inscriptions we have there. What can we say about contextually what that relationship would be? But keep your eyes out for that. I mean, we mentioned this earlier because it's part of the overall Nahom correlation here. Haram itself is like right on the frankincense trail. It's right where it's literally 4 miles west of the exact point where it turned east. And being 4 miles west means you just go further east to get to that exact point where the trail turns east, right? So
Nephi says we did turn nearly eastward at that, you know, after the burial, they turned nearly eastward.
Exactly.
That connects. So it really is, we're talking about, it's right in the turf of where it's supposed to be. I mean, we can debate whether the tribe was at the site or not, but there's some evidence to suggest yes, or some correspondence.
There's some kind of connection there,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. I mean, that's fantastic. I always go back to like the beginning of this discussion that we had. Really, what we have is all these correspondences converging together. And we were talking about a biblical site. Just knowing what I know from my background in archaeology and how light certain sites get to be positively identified, it's hard for me to stress there's an awful lot here. Yes, we don't overstep our bounds and go, oh, for sure, this is this and that is that. But boy, in the ancient world and the difficulty we have in understanding that world, and especially when we get into specifics, not generalities, this is pretty strong. There's a lot of strength here.
I absolutely agree. And, you know, yeah, going back to that discussion, you'll remember I mentioned a lot of biblical sites are identified on nothing more than the modern Arabic name for the site.
Exactly.
And there's an assumed history of tradition. Well, we had that. We had that evidence as soon as Warren Aston went out to Yemen and found out, this is the modern name of the area is Nehem, right? We had that kind of evidence right there in the 1980s. Our evidence has only gotten better since then. And sometimes I get a little flustered or frustrated because I feel like if you had this level of evidence for any other text,
any biblical site, any other text
that is regarded as ancient, right?
It would be undisputed.
No one would question that this is the correlation. That's the place. They probably still would be like, well, we can't know if that's the specific Ishmael because, you know, whatever. But
people would talk about it.
They would talk about it. There'd be no question, though, that this is the place. This is the right area, the right time, all of that. There'd be absolutely no question about this. It's only because this is the Book of Mormon that people say, well, but is it really? Is it really? And they want to, you know, they want the evidence to be so specific. And some of them, I can tell you one reaction I saw to my article was from someone. They basically said, well, even if you had an inscription that said, here lays Ishmael, he was buried by Nephi, son of Lehi.
Father-in-law to Lehi. Yeah.
Yeah. Like even if the inscription said that and it was in Hebrew or whatever, or it was in Reformed Egyptian, so we knew it was from foreigners or whatever. Like, even if you had all that in place, he's like, it still wouldn't prove anything because the Book of Mormon has all these other problems. And I'm just like, well, look, I can't reason with someone who has just decided it can't be true no matter what the evidence is, right? Like, that's just, you know, we can't do anything about that. So yeah, it's just because it's the Book of Mormon. Raises all these red flags for people. And so they say, no, the evidence has to be so good. And then even if it is so good, we probably still won't believe you anyway. And it's just like, well, okay.
When you're asking for archaeological evidence, I hope everybody walks away from this hour discussion going, well, this is what archaeological evidence looks like. Yeah. This is what that looks like.
This is my rule. My rule. You don't have to believe the Book of Mormon or whatever, but my basic rule is, you don't get to ask for better evidence than can be reasonably expected and that we actually tend to see from actual studies of either the Bible and archaeology or other written texts and archaeology. I've actually found it really interesting to learn about the Amarna letters, which are a corpus of letters from the 14th century BC. They're from Egypt, but they were written by Canaanite rulers and written to the Egyptian ruler who kind of was an overlord of the time. I've been fascinated by studies on the archaeology of that time period that are constantly finding, well, the Amarna letters say this city is here at this time, but we can't find it. Archaeology isn't finding the city, but we know it's there because it's in the letters. I have this rule. I say, no, if you can expect evidence, let's talk about evidence. Let's expect evidence. Let's expect good evidence.
Sure.
But you can't, the rules are you can't expect anything better or more specific than what can reasonably be expected when we actually go out and see what kind of evidence tends to support different ancient texts when they're compared to archaeology. I actually find the Book of Mormon does do better than some ancient texts sometimes in some respects.
I agree. That would surprise a lot of people, but I agree. We have to have an honest discussion about this, and I could probably eat up a whole nother podcast with you on that. Sure. But I so agree that I think we have to start looking apples to apples and have a fair discussion about it because evidence is there. There is tangible, hands-on evidence that's there.
Yeah, absolutely. If you don't stack the deck against the Book of Mormon, you take the time to figure out what kind of evidence is usually used for this kind of thing and what can be reasonably expected here. I tend to find the Book of Mormon tends to have exactly the kind of evidence you should expect from it.
And even in this case, probably beyond our wildest expectations.
Probably better than what we really could have expected. Absolutely. this is just something you just have to, when you understand those overall expectations, I find the Book of Mormon does just fine. And I like to tell people, it may not convince a skeptic. I think if you're willing to be fair, you'll start to realize, hey, there's more than there should be here. There's more evidence than there should be. If there's smoke, there's fire kind of thing, right? Like there's more evidence than there should be, and it's worth taking a closer look at than a lot of people realize.
Well, thank you so much, Neil. I have considered this such a treat. I'm blown away at being able to be just kind of tapped in here at this early stage of this article coming out. I'm just thrilled. You work at Book of Mormon Central. I want to give you a plug. Your article came out in the Interpreter Foundation. I want to give that a plug. There will be links, you know, in the notes under the podcast when this goes out. Book of Mormon Central, fantastic repository of material. It's all about Book of Mormon and research. The new evidence platform website that you guys came out with, another fun thing that it keeps growing every time I'm on it. There's more there. That's great. Are there anything else, new projects, anything you want to plug, Book of Mormon Central-wise or research-wise that you're involved in?
No, I mean, just, yeah, keep an eye out on what we're doing. We've always got new stuff coming down the pipeline. New content is coming out on a weekly basis, sometimes on a daily basis. I would also say, especially, you mentioned our Evidence Central platform. Keep an eye out on there, especially if you're interested in Book of Mormon evidence. We've got new stuff going up. We've got 3 or 4 new articles on that going up every single week. Really excellent stuff. We have somewhere around 220, I think, up right now. And we hope to be in the thousands someday, right? That's just, we believe the Book of Mormon has that kind of support, and we want to show that.
My last question, which I always try to make a real doozy for the person that I'm interviewing here. All right. So you started working at Book of Mormon Central right from the beginning. You were there at the ground floor with Jack Welch. Awesome stuff. My question is, was that really a work-related research story, or was it a love story? Because, and tell us the truth, Neil, tell us the truth. Did you start working at Book of Mormon Central just to get to know a cutie that was in the room who eventually became your future wife?
You know, I guess it's a little bit of both a research and a love story. but I can honestly say I started working here for research purposes, or the job opportunity that it was, really, because I had not actually met her when I was contacted about potentially working here. And for me, it was kind of a dream come true.
I would say so.
When I started getting into doing research like this stuff, jobs like this didn't exist, right? Yeah. There was no job to go do this, at least not for us, right? And so this kind of came around. I don't remember how long it was. I think it was very early on, though. We have a staff meeting within like the first couple weeks, and there's this girl, Jasmine.
Here we go.
She was, as I like to say, as I first met her and started to get to know her, she's more attractive than I am, for sure, right? Like, I'm like, wow, she's really
cute. There's no doubt for any of us, right? This goes without saying. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm like, wow, she's really cute. But as I got to know her, I realized she's actually really smart, and she's really funny too. And I started to think, you know, I don't really have much of a chance over here, because I usually rely on being kind of smart and funny to attract the girls, but she's smarter and funnier than I am. So she's just out of my league. Time goes on, and our bosses have sometimes liked to pitch that as Book of Mormon Central's biggest success story. Not any of the content we've created, but the fact that they have formed a union out of this, right? So,
well, I give you a ton of credit. I know this, if my wife had to work with me every day, and if that had to be the place where I was going to bring the love story in, there would be a 0% chance that my wife would be married to me right now. So I give you guys a ton of credit, and just thanks for indulging me on the lighter question there.
No problem. No problem. It was a pleasure.
Well, thank you so much for your time, for your expertise, for sharing. And I appreciate and value everything you've brought to the table. I hope everybody else does as well. But Neil Rapley, best success in your future research. And thank you so much for joining us today on Book of Mormon History.
Great. Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That's a wrap for this podcast. I'd like to thank our special guest, Neil Rapley, who discovered a funerary stone with the inscribed name Ishmael, dating to the right time and right place as Book of Mormon events. For more information, you can visit us online at www.bookofmormonhistory.com and like and subscribe to the Book of Mormon History podcast wherever you tune in. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk together soon.